House Committee on Labor and Business Affairs, Tuesday, February 18, 1975, work session.
House Labor Committee have come to order. I'm going to start in on. Take note of number seven, please. You already have. Okay, 2234. Anybody have any comments? Want to do anything?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Have we, in fact, adopted the proposed amendments? Or were they just proposed and not acted upon?
Just proposed. No, those amendments were adopted in addition. This came from the addition. At the second typed up copy that you have is what we received. They were adopted in addition. This is how it comes to us.
But they were not engrossed?
Yes, they were. Well, you have copies of that.
No, I don't
know. Bill has been amended.
Somehow.
I don't have a copy of those.
I have a sufficient.
Copy of the amendment
in
the bill.
Do you have a
reprint? We didn't order a reprint.
I don't know.
We don't order it.
You say it was in growth?
I don't have a copy of it was.
Mr. Chairman, don't we have to, as a committee, don't we have to direct?
Judiciary was supposed to.
Because
the amendment was made in addition, so it has been amended.
Okay. There was an amendment.
Yeah, you have a copy of the amendment.
No, I mean,
The
amendment was pending. Oh. Actually, pending.
But this is the bill the way
it comes to us.
Right.
So, yeah, there's nothing to address.
No, not on amendment. There isn't.
And this amendment has been built into this printed copy. So we have to read.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the bill to the floor with the impact recommendation.
Second that.
Okay, where's the motion? Any discussion? Carry the follow rule.
Aye.
Representative Gruder would like to carry this bill. Unit price.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
In 2086, I have some proposed amendments, and my secretary is bringing them up at the same moment, and they're being Xeroxed off. And after considering the bill to quite an extent and talking with different people that own stores and small stores and big stores and whatnot. And I had my student intern also yesterday go out and do some checking on prices in stores that have unit pricing and also stores that don't have unit pricing. And I found that there's a little higher cost in the stores that do have unit pricing. However, there's unit pricing takes a little broader scope than we're actually looking at in this bill, I think. And that is the point of we're going in the future to kind of a scanning checkout, a data processing checkout. What this is, they'll use a light, a scanning beam for your product, and you'll scan, it has the new products now have a little bars on little computer bars, and you'll scan this in front of a light. What this is going to entail is that the product in the future will not be stamped. It won't have the price on the top in the future. Like right now, you get a can of green beans, and they have 69 cents printed on the top. They're going to do away with this, and they're going to go to, when they have this scanning checkout system, they'll have to print up a label to begin with. So the store will have to have a computer to go to this process. At this time, they'll probably all automatically go to unit pricing. They're only going to have to add another three figures to their label that they're going to have to print anyway. And so I agree with the bill if we can amend Section 10 on page 5 to read that this bill would not take effect until the time that a store went to the electronic scanning checkout system. This wouldn't entail any more cost to the people that own the stores. And right now, I understand we have these are some amendments to the bill. It wouldn't cost any more for a store when they go to this electronic checkout to go to unit pricing at the same time. Like I say, they're going to only have to add another three figures. They're going to have to print on the label to begin with. And so I think if we go to it at this time with the effective date that it does have on it, we're going to push some people to go into unit pricing prior to the time that they might be ready. I mean, someone might not have their computer system set up to print these things out, so they're going to have to go to an additional cost. And I put figures from $3,000 to $28,000 per year. And if we're putting $28,000 a year on top of someone's grocery bill, it's absolutely crazy to me. You know, I mean, that would be for the whole store. But still, there's going to be an additional cost if we pressure these stores to go into this type of a system too early. And so I would like the committee to accept these amendments, and I'll move these amendments into the bill at this time.
Mr.
Chairman, this then would be upon the when each store would take up this scanner checkout system, which then would become under unit pricing.
Well, correct.
Now, you made a comment earlier that you had sent somebody out to the stores and you noticed that the prices were higher.
In the stores that have unit pricing right now.
Now, of course, the decision as to the why is probably just no, but you tell me why you think they were higher.
Why I think they are higher? Because I think the stores that do have unit pricing at this current time, it is costing them more to unit price. Because that's an additional cost to stick that sticker that they have to put up there right now. They have to put a little sticker underneath the shelf where the product sits. Also, they are now stamping the top of the can, like green beans or whatever, and stamping it that it costs 69 cents. The point I was trying to make is in the future, when you go to scanning checkout, you eliminate stamping the top of the can. So automatically, you have to go to the sticker. You're going to have to use the sticker. So what I'm saying is, by the time the store goes to scanning checkout, they're going to have the stickers anyway. And all they're going to have to do is print an additional three or four numbers at the same time for the unit price. A computer can figure a unit price like that. And what I'm saying is I don't want to force the stores now to abide by this effective date we have on here, March 1st, 1976, because some store might not be ready with their computer at this time.
The question I have is, electronic scanning system, does it work? What happens when it doesn't work? What is the reception of the shop or two? Electronic scanning. I don't know if you had an opportunity to read this particular.
Yes. Yeah, I have that.
I really wonder if we know what thunder we're doing.
Well, what are we talking about? We have two issues here before us. I think then if we start talking about electronic checkout on one hand, it's automation. People have always in the past been opposed to advancement you know, the car came out. What happened back when the car came out? You know, the horse and buggies were on the streets, and also the cars were on the streets, and everybody was, you know, those damn cars, we don't need them, you know, we got our old horse and buggies. So I think it's the same thing with standing checkout. It's going to save the consumer money in the long run. Right now, labor costs are so high in the stores where you have a clerk checking things out. Some in Portland area, it's around $4.50 an hour. They also have those people stamping the top of the product when they're not checking out. They can go to these data processing machines where they would scan, and they're not going to have to pay the operator of a cash register as much, because scanning, you just wave in front of a light and pick the product up, and it's not much skill involved as compared to right now where the checkout clerk will go through and push the numbers. And I might add, if you want to talk about the scanners, they will be more accurate because human error is less of what a data processing machine will make. But I think it is a separate issue, the scanning checkout system.
Mr. Chairman, let me ask this to Representative Davis one more question. We're talking about the cost to the consumer. We're talking about the cost of the scanning equipment and the cost of unit prices. There's one other additional cost that has not received much attention, and that is the cost to implement this act and to carry it out. Now, I submit to you that we've had testimony that would state that this will just become a normal process with no additional manpower. Department of Agriculture, when they're in the store, they'll also check in the prices. I don't believe that for a minute. I don't believe that the Department of Agriculture will do that. I personally think that if we enact unit pricing, sometime during the interim, you'll see a request to the emergency board for people, manpower, officers to carry out unit pricing. And I do not accept the premise that the Department of Agriculture, the director, can have a fee schedule of from $0 to $250 for fine schedule for violations, and he can pick the figure that he wants. In other words, if we're going to go to this point of unit pricing, one, let's find out exactly what it is it's going to cost to carry out the implementation of the act. Two, let's nail down what the fine schedule is going to be. So one character isn't making the decision, playing judge and jury. Now that's fair, isn't it?
No, what's fair?
The director has a fee schedule that's set so that he doesn't have the discretion. Isn't that fair?
No, I don't believe we have to extend the powers to our agencies to use their discretion, the power of a fine. I think a fine from zero to a $250 is anything exorbitant for a company like Fred Meyer's, maybe that you know, does $10 million worth of sales. And the stores I've talked with, you know, getting back to the scan and checkout, I'm talking about amending the bill. I cannot go with the bill in its present form that the effective date it has on it, because you're right, Representative Morris, in that it will cost the stores, not only the stores, but the consumers that we're talking about. It's going to cost them more money if we go to it in its present form. What I'm saying is people really do want unit pricing, and I think that there are people that do, and I don't think it's a real small percentage. I think it's enough to be concerned about. Let's give it to them at a time when it's acceptable to the merchants, the people in the stores, and acceptable to the consumer, in that it's not going to put any additional cost on him, because they're going to convert to unit pricing at the time it's appropriate for them. And this is why I keep getting back to, we ought to do it when they go to scan and checkout, because they're prepared for it. I'm sure we can, if you want to take some testimony from any of the store owners here, that they won't have any objections to going to it at that time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anything else?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not convinced that much cost involved in setting it up and being passed on to the consumer. There's a lot of testimony that there is. I haven't seen that much documentation. I think we have to bear in mind that this electronic scanner checkout system is coming. It's here now in some places, and in the future, we're going to see it probably in all the major stores. And my my concern is that these prices are not going to be available readily to the consumer, and unless there's something like unit pricing, the consumer is not going to be protected. I hope when they get to the scanner checkout system, it works a little better in our voting system, and that they have something in reserve like a roll call vote to be able to proceed with the checkout. But I think we have to keep that in mind, that we've got to keep these prices available for consumers, that they can really be hurt by this, that people will use it if they know it's there, and those that do know that the system is there, I feel, and I've talked to a lot of people, that when they know it's there, they use it, and they use it for their benefit. And those people that and it's the same old story, that can least afford to plagiarize, be hurt by the high price today, are the ones that would, I think, use it all the more and benefit those individuals. And certainly I'm not on a limited income. I'm a lot better off than many people financially, but I know my wife is a comparison shopper, and she checks out prices very closely. And without those prices marked on individual pieces of merchandise, I don't know where else they'll go. So I'm very much in favor of this. I think that I would agree with the amendment in order to see this bill reached before. So I believe I would vote to support the amendment and the amended bill.
So this wouldn't require it on each individual item?
No. No, I know this wouldn't.
No, the bill itself doesn't.
No, I know.
Oh, I thought you said that
with
one of each item.
No, with the electronic scanner checkout system, it will not have this. You will not see the prices anymore. And at the end of the same year, I see the unit price.
Any further questions?
Yeah,
at the beginning of the debate on this issue, or the hearing on this issue, it seemed to me like I recall it being in the best interest of the consumer that we have unit prices. And now, after listening to the proposer of the motion and the person speaking in favor of it, it becomes apparent that the reason the motion is being made to amend this thing is so that we get it out of committee. But at the same time, it almost makes it a non-bill, because the stores that have unit pricing now have it. And the stores that don't have it are going to get it, evidently, by the admission of the proposal in motion when they go to the electronic scanner system anyway. So what in the world is the purpose of the bill at this point? I would like to know if the amendment passes. The people who were strongly in favor of the bill a week or two ago now are making it almost a non-bill.
No, if when they go to the scanner, you're not going to have unit price as such. You would have the price posted for items and not unit prices, not by unit. What this would do is when they went to the electronic scanner, they would have to have, along with the price of the item, they would have to have a unit price posted.
Yeah, but I wasn't clear in making my point, I guess. The point is that if 2 weeks ago the bill was needed now, and now all of a sudden the bill isn't needed now, and the point I'm trying to establish is this motion being made as a compromise to get this bill out of the committee to the floor? Is that why the motion is being made, or is it being made in the best interest of the consumer?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'm rephrasing here, but I believe, hasn't this bill been around for the last two times, something like that? It's been around for a while, the idea of unit pricing.
It's not price.
Yeah, okay.
It's not price.
What I'm saying is that I think we're going to have to go to unit pricing at some time, because it is beneficial for a portion of the public, the consuming public. And what I'm saying is, sure, we compromise. That's what this whole political process is about. We have to compromise. Everyone has a difference of opinion. What I'm trying to do is make it acceptable and feasible and economical for the merchants to go to it and for the consumers to get it. What are we supposed to do? Just kill the bill here and say, well, hell, there it goes again. You know, how much cost have we got in this bill right now? Why don't we try to fix it up and get it out of here
and let the people vote on it and enact it into law and upon these scanners, when they are implemented into the stores, they will know that they have to write into their computer program that we got to, you know, make a little calculation here for unit pricing. And so at that time, it's not going to hurt them one bit. It might cost them $5, something like that, if that at all. And so if you want to say I'm compromising, I guess you can say that to some extent.
I personally could not accept this bill the way it was. But I can with this amendment. My personal opinion.
Good. I respect your opinion, too, Mr. Chairman, but I'd like to direct another question.
Sure.
To propose a motion. Didn't you say that you thought that that at the time the stores went to the electronic scanner system, they would go to unit pricing anyway?
It would be feasible for them at that time to go to unit pricing. However, they might choose not to do so. What we're saying by this law would say that you're going to be required at that time to make sure you go to unit pricing. That's all the bill is going to say. And what's going to happen if we don't enact the bill is that you might have some people with it, some people without it, and it's going to be harder for them to convert afterwards. You know, like if we come along, you know, 5 years from now and say, well, okay, we're going to require unit pricing, and then they're going to have to go back in and change all their labels and change their computer programs and print a unit price. And what I'm saying is it's like a person building a house now. Doggone it, you know, they go to build something like the AMAX plant. They keep lowering their standard and say, okay, first you have a pound and a half of fluoride for aluminum and so on and so forth. What I'm saying is let's lay down the rules far enough in advance for these merchants, for these stores, so that they know what criteria they are going to have to meet. So if we tell them now, okay, we're going to have unit pricing, they're going to go, it's not going to cost them any of these little costs at all that I can see.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ross.
Clarify something. Are we seeking to the proposed amendment or are we seeking to the entire bill? Are we seeking to the proposed amendment here or to the entire bill?
The amendment. The present time.
I call for the question on the amendment.
Aye. Amendment has been accepted.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
You just made a statement that I think, Representative Davis, is very important. You said, let us establish the rules by which the stores know how they're going to operate under unit pricing. Then why is it such an unreasonable approach to establish rules for the state of Oregon, for the department, on how we want them to carry out the act? Why is that an unreasonable request?
We have established that.
The heck we have. Show it to me.
We're relieving the discretion of the Department of Agriculture to let
That's
it.
Nothing. All that is a license for them to open up the door and they can carry out the act any way they want to. All they've got to do is after you go home, they go to the e-board and they say, this is our program, give us the money. You haven't established a thing for them.
Absolutely
nothing.
If I can reply to that, Mr. Chairman, I don't...
That's what we're stationed for.
I don't believe that we're... Not us, but the Department of Agriculture is going to be going before the board and requesting funds. This bill now with this amendment in it is just. I don't see anybody how we're going to have any problem on enforcing this bill because the merchants. You know, let's be realistic. The merchants are going to implement it, and the Department of Agriculture. You know, they're not going to go out there and check every store every day. It's not going to cost them that much money. It really isn't. I can't see it at all.
Anytime and every time, any state agency assumes a new additional responsibility, it takes manpower and dollars and space.
Right.
That costs us money.
move the table of House Bill 287.
Stay with my debate. Agnes?
No.
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 Aye.
Aye.
No.
Nope. Been defeated, naturally. Now we'll start in again.
Okay.
Anything else on the bill itself?
Yes. Yeah, I would like to propose an amendment to section 11, and to this act, section 10, to this act.
No, this, no, we've already.
Yeah, I understand that.
Okay.
This section 10, to this act takes effect or whenever
yeah.
the change is.
Yeah.
I would like to put in section 11 that this act is repealed as of June 30, 1981. And the reason for that is, and it's kind of along my one man's determination to try to eliminate things. Then one of two things will happen. Everyone's just stirring along from that. Go to electronic scanning, they'll be doing it anyway. Okay, so they go along and they do it and we don't have any problems. Then whoever, the Department of Agriculture, whoever has the function at that time, then has to come in and prove that there's a harm. And that's, and we get kind of bureaucratic inertia. And if you don't agree with me, then it's fine. But at any rate, I got my kind of one-man campaign to try to cut off the bureaucratic inertia path. And if there's a good reason for it, then we can just simply extend it another 5 years or whatever. And that's the reason behind it.
Good motion. Any discussion?
Question.
What was the date?
June 39.
Did you get that, Agnes?
June,
pardon?
June 30th, 1981.
I'd like to call the roll on that amendment. Section 11. Cut off date of 1981.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. That was an awful strong aye.
First good one I've heard.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I was just looking over these amendments I had to my secretary type in. I see if you failed to put in section 10, where I have where it says to take effect March 1st, 1976. This new amendment should also be implemented under section 10 the same way, take effect upon implementation of electronic scanner. I would like to go through a vote on that at this time.
Say that again?
Okay, now we went, well, the way this thing says, it says, the summary on my amendment. Can we just change that to section 10, or did we?
Well, no, we deleted all of section 10.
Okay,
as
okay,
bill
okay fine.
Added,
I
added
just
want
to make sure that was understood.
Okay, then make that section 10.
On my handout, I had
no. Summary. No, no, it's still section 11. So all we did, we deleted this and added this also. Section 10. So you want section 11.
All right.
Did we?
What?
What?
We didn't take.
Yeah.
Huh?
You sure did. And whose amendment?
Chairman, I think the amendment pertained only to the summary.
Well,
that isn't what I stated. We would at least take the.
And that's what I meant to have changed with
yeah.
section 10, in, I see by mistake.
The summary, we don't have anything to do with changing
okay.
that.
Okay.
Yeah. That's right. We
subsection 2 and definition of a grocery store.
That's
right.
And
the other one.
Yeah,
that's where
yeah,
it is. Okay. Well, I don't think we don't need C. We can just delete A. Delete A and insert this because we don't need A anymore.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah.
Sub 2A right here, Mr. Chairman. And we don't need this dollar value limitation anymore.
and then we can just insert.
Well, that's right.
For purposes of the grocery store, we can use electronic optical scanners, so it comes under the definition of grocery store as soon as they go to the optical scanner section.
Would it?
For the purposes of the enterprise.
Well, we still want this though.
Well, no, because you see, all this is doing over here on section 10 is saying when the bill goes into
that's
effect,
right.
You
right.
want the bill to go into effect after the session's over, and then it's the self-actuator in the law. As soon as a store goes to electronic scanning, then it automatically comes under the Act. But the Act itself has to go into effect right after the session, or, well, I don't want to put an emergency clause on it because that's important. I don't like those. And I think that would solve our problems with the.
Now let's just exactly what you have in mind here.
Okay.
You're doing a lot of talking back and forth, but I don't think anybody understands what you've been saying.
No. If we leave section 10 alone,
we already changed it.
But if we leave that alone, then the Act has a definite date when it comes into effect. And the problem with the amendment that apparently we've adopted. As it says, it takes effect upon implementation of electronic scanner checkout system.
Mm-hmm.
Where? Does this mean that if Safeway has one in and Albertson doesn't, is the Act in effect or isn't it?
Yeah.
So we've got a problem with that. So my suggestion is that you leave Section 10 alone. Go to Section 2 on page 3 to Section A. And as Representative Wolfer has suggested, delete all the language in A and add the word utilizes an electronic scanner checkout system. So what you have done then is left 10 alone and made the definition of a grocery store or food market to mean only one that utilizes an electronic scanner checkout system. So you've solved the problem of giving the Act a definite date, and any store that does not have an electronic scanner checkout system, the Act doesn't apply to them. And as soon as they put one in, it does. Roger.
Mr. Chairman, a question that comes to my mind is how do you detect when someone has gone to this scanner system?
Somebody walks into the store.
Isn't there some problems here, implementation for people charged with enforcing this?
No, I don't think so. For the simple reason, anybody that's going to the system is going to be a large enough store, they're going to have, their people are going to know what the law is. And if you don't think they don't, you got to see how many calls I've got.
Yes,
there's one of them sitting right there.
I don't know whether really that wise to take up some kind of a volume floor on this or not. Whether 1.5 million is the proper volume or not, I don't know. Because there's a possibility that a very small store could go through the scanner checkout. And this would be a problem with them with using.
Not really. If they went to the scanner checkout, they'd have to go to it anyway. Because if they have to have it printed out so they can put the poster price on the shelf.
They're going to have it hooked up into a computer, and the guy who's been stamping the cans can go around and see the unit pricing labels up.
I've got another question. This scanner checkout really bothers
me. Sure, hell to have a bad back and have to stand up all day.
It really bothers me because I think it's going to create some problems for the consumer, perhaps. Does this mean that this price is fixed at the processing plant that puts the label on?
Answer that, Mr. Chairman?
You sure may.
Okay, what we're speaking of the little bars on the side of the cans. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, what we're talking about. Okay, that number that appears on there, which you can't read, it's signified by bars, is a stock reorder number. It is not a price on there. And a lot of people under the impression that it's a price, and it's not. It's a stock reorder number, And internally in the computer, management sets the price of a certain stock reorder number, like stock order number 101 is set at 69 cents today. Tomorrow they can say stock order 010 is set at $1.95 if they so wish. So it's set internally in the computer, so I can't see any problem.
So then if they have a sale, then all I have to do is reprogram the computer for certain items.
Correct.
Of course, and they still have to print out, because they're going to have a price posted on the shelves somewhere. All this would require them to do is add the unit price to their ordinary price, really. Because they're going to have that label printed out anyway. I can't hardly see my wife or your wife walking down an aisle and picking up something she doesn't know the price of. Not hardly.
But it's kind of hard to compare cans when you don't have the prices. You know, let's say you're four or five different things and you're sitting there juggling them trying to figure out how much they are. It's kind of easy when you can look at the price on the thing that you've forgotten. But if they don't have anybody's really bars, I can see where it really presents a problem.
I appreciate that. And that's the reason I kind of wonder if people are not going to object to picking these things up without some kind of price actually on them. If on a large order, they're not going to know whether they're being cheated when it runs through that scanner.
Well, that's why they're going to have a deal on the shelf, not on the item itself, but on the shelf of the item here.
But in a large order, the person's memory is going to fail before he gets to the checkout.
I'll buy that.
You're not going to know whether that can of beans is really 29 cents or 30 cents.
Retail clerk would be happy if we amended this so that each item had to be stamped.
there are two places here that in section 6, line 19, it instructs that the 5 consecutive business days, and this would be a sale situation. Now, would this be needed anymore?
No,
it
really wouldn't.
It says that a price lower than the price at which the commodity was then sold or not be sale. Why not? Why wouldn't it still be needed?
Yes. Okay, let's think about it a minute.
Mr. Chairman?
Mm-hmm.
If I can answer that, I do feel that it would be needed, because what's going to happen when they have a sale? They're going to go to a sale maybe for a day or two, and they're not going to want to utilize their computer to print out new labels.
Yeah.
Because they're going to keep the standard price. What they'll do is they'll just stick the handwritten price over the sticker price. And so this will allow them, so they don't have to print out a new unit price.
I have a question then. When they go to the checkout with the sale price with a little reorder number on it,
right,
the computer has to have been told it's a different price, right?
Correct. But they don't have.
And what's the problem with printing the label out?
Well, it's going to be an additional costume. I don't see why they...
Well, they're going to have a run every night anyway.
Well,
it's going to be... I don't know whether they're going to be batch or real time, but anyway, if they've got to change the price on the system, what's the problem with having the system print a verification?
I don't see the need for it.
Well, they have to go in, they have to take the process of changing the price. So somebody puts in, tells us, okay, the price is now this.
Mm-hmm.
What additional problem is requiring it to say printed on a line printer somewhere on a label? What additional expense is that going to be?
Yeah. They might do it during the middle of the day. They might come and say, let's have a sale on this at 12 o'clock, and they're not running their printer at this time for new labels. But they can go back and change the unit price or the price of the product inside the computer.
Well, just from what I know of our grocery stores, they know in advance what the sale and the whole thing.
So I don't think that arbitrary decisions are made on sale items. I think sometimes in most cases you find a plan days in advance or maybe even weeks in advance.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I think that a little store up in Oak Ridge might depend upon the mail service to bring those labels from Seattle or Portland or San Francisco or somewhere. And I think that
they can't if they have the electronic scanning.
There's
no way that they can.
They're not going to have a printer in that store.
They can't have the electronic checkout unless they have into time sharing or something. They cannot have that system without a computer.
Right, but they can have their input at that store. They can punch their input in at that store.
If they're punching their input
into the computer center.
Correct. print, but if they're putting it out, if they're going to go to that system, they'll have a, if they have input into a timeshare, they're going to have output from a timeshare. You don't do it without it.
But this would require that store to have a printing unit then to do the printing.
Any store that has an input item has to have an output item in a data processing.
Mr. Chairman, I would call upon your memory to think back to the last session of legislature, when we got in trouble in some committees because of the very thing that's happening here right now. I, for one, do not have enough knowledge on electronic scanner checkout or whatever it is, and neither does anybody else in this room, frankly, in my opinion anyway. And we've changed the entire intent of this bill from a unit pricing bill to an electronic scanner checkout bill. And here we are talking, and I've heard everybody here as soon as the discussion say, well, I think this, and I think that, and I don't really think myself that anybody knows for sure exactly how this thing works. Except maybe a couple of people that work with computers. Now, I'm going to make a motion that we postpone the work session on this bill until the first order of business at our next work session, in order to give the administrative assistant and the chairman a chance to go through the bill, and I'd be happy to go through it with him, and to propose some amendments that we're kicking around here, but we don't really seem to know what we're talking about. And so I would like to move that we postpone further action on this bill until the first order of business at our next work session.
Mr. Chairman, if I could speak to that. When you're talking about electronics, each company has what is, quote, their own system. And there's many variations. You can get anybody who's a systems analyst or knows about the computer checkout, and he can tell you what X brand does and what Y brand does. But unless we pass a law that says for computer checkout, you've got to do the following thing, you're going to get variations. So there's a number of ways. It's just like anything else. You have a problem. Let's say you want to go to computer checkout, and there's any number of ways with a certain level of equipment. Just like with a phone company, you have a communications problem, but there's any number of ways you can solve that problem within a certain framework. And that's really why you say, well, that's where the problem comes in. Each different company kind of has advantages and disadvantages with their particular system. And that's what it is. Now, sure, if you want to get, I'm not adverse to additional testimony or expertise or whatever you want to call it, but you're not going to get a black and white, this is the way it's going to be type thing, because there's too much variation in equipment and software. This is the way it is.
Representative Davis.
Chairman, in regards to Representative Wilhelm's comment about postponing this bill, I think we're just going to be postponing it. It's something that we could do today. I said he wants some expertise, and I've been a computer specialist for the last 5 years. I think I'm an expert in the bill. Granted, Representative Wolfer and myself are basically the only ones that know what we're talking about when we're talking about electronic scan and checkout. I think some other members understand it also. But the intricacies of the system, I think we understand. And what we're saying is we're not trying to get this, the electronic checkout, we're not trying to read this into the bill. What we're trying to do is offer an alternative to the effective date of this system, so that we're not costing the stores an additional amount of money. What we're saying is we want the stores, they're not going to have to go to it until we go to electronic checkout, because at that time they are going to have a computer system that can print out a unit price, and that's the problem now. That's why all the stores are writing and saying we don't want unit pricing, because we have to have a computer that'll print out these labels to figure the unit price. So let's get away from electronic scanning and say when they do have electronic scanning, they are ready to go to unit pricing. Let's make it take effect at that time. And if you can accept Representative Wolfers and my comments on electronic checkout, then I think expedite the matter of this bill.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I can accept your comments, but I see people sitting around here trying to amend this bill today, and we're trying to draft amendments while we're sitting here. Now, that's the purpose of the work session, all right. But I see no problem with postponing further action on this thing so that our salaried staff, whose job it is to work on these amendments, can have a little time to fall back and regroup, along with our chairman and yourself. You've got the expertise. Great. I'll trust your judgment. But I don't think we need to sit here all morning and probably into the afternoon kicking around whether or not we're going to amend the various sections of this bill. I think we ought to sit down, we're quiet, go through the thing, and prepare some amendments, and then bring them back and propose them and talk about them and get it done.
Anything else?
Well, I'm inclined somewhat to agree with you, Gary, because I know we went through this last session, amending a lot of bills, and ended up we had them all amended goofy because we got in a hurry. I'm inclined to think that we would be better off that I think we have the intent. We know what everybody wants, the intent. And I think you have some idea that you would like to have some time to amend amendments in. And we could work on those so we'd have them in the proper order with LC so we know exactly. We don't do like we did last time with some of these bills.
Mr. Chairman, what's the route of travel for this bill? Does it have any subsequent referral? It
does not. Anything else on Representative Wilhelm's motion?
Aye.
Okay.
Aye.
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 Aye. First order of business, our next work session. You have the notes of all we want. We'll get to working on that immediately because we have a real work session very shortly.
That will be also included in that.
Yeah. See how that works. We'll have all the amendments printed and we can decide which ones we want.
Does the committee want a person that knows about this then? Or
you mean to talk to us about it?
Yeah, or electronic check.
I could care less. I'll take the word of the committee members that haven't had experience with this field. Would you like to have somebody come in and explain it to us?
Well, I think so. I mean, I've heard different people talk about it, and I'm not casting any doubt on the judge, Representative Davis, and Representative Wolf, or people who have been in my office and talked about it, but I've never had anybody come in and explain the technology of it and the variations. I heard some comments here today, which to me prove that there's some people on the committee, myself included, who just lack the knowledge to make a sound judgment on this, and I would like it.
Right,
some testimony from somebody who could orient us on
the next work session. We'll get somebody in this field to explain it to us. How's that?
I'd appreciate it. I think it goes a little beyond just taking a look at a can of cat food. Then mighty stripes are read by a computer. Now we're experts on scanning.
Speaking of that, you know how to sabotage the computer because of the phone.
We'll still be talking 6 months from now. And then some. All right, now we'll start in on 2157. Any good comments? Representative Kress, move this before we do pass?
Yes, I would. So, Mr. Chairman.
That's what I thought I heard. Any discussion on it? Motion to send forward the two-path recommendation, 2157. No discussion?
Could you refresh our memory just a little bit, yeah. Chairman, and briefly?
I'll attempt to. On what?
On the bill.
What it does?
Heard you comment about the other day.
You mean what this bill does?
Yeah. This, again,
quite frankly, very little. My way of looking at it. It says that you can't advertise the newspaper, or not the newspaper, the employer can't advertise for strike breakers if they have a truck plant unless they tell them that's what they're hiring them for. It also says if you three times in the last 5 years you went into a plant where they've been on strike and hired out of then you're a strike breaker. You have to do it three times. On the third time around, you're classed as a strike breaker.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that it seems fairer if you say instead of saying professional strike breakers, put down professional collective bargaining disruptor or something like that. No, now I'm not kidding. And put down not only our collective bargaining, but I'd have something like that, so that would refer equally to a strike breaker as to a professional ticket service. And so that, you know, because then the business community doesn't get all uptight about it. You know, it's just against us and that kind of thing. And at the same time, you know, I have a thing for kind of equality and so forth, and it seems to me any constraint on labor or on business should be equally shared by both parties. What I mean is the same type of restraint exists for the labor as well as for business or vice versa.
I'd be curious to hear Representative Wolfer's definition of a professional
ticketer.
A person who gets paid, who is not a member of the union, a party to it, who comes in and, what should I say, does the tickets for money. You know, like a professional strike breaker, he comes in for money.
Doesn't for a wage.
Right. And you know, if a person, like, if they have an international union, let's say, like right here, you can bring them in from your non-union outlet from a store under this, and they can bring them in for their international from somewhere else. You know, and all I'm saying is I think that, you know, really, when it gets down to where it gets down to a lockout or a strike, it's really a war, you know, like a political campaign or something, and each side, I don't see us in the legislature as, what should I say, making legally unless there's sufficient harm to prove that it shouldn't be done. They put in a constraint on one side that we don't put on the other. That's all I'm saying.
Why don't you get a bill drawn up that effect and we'll give it to the committee?
All right.
I think it should be in the same one.
Why?
Well, I think you know very well why.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I might be able to help you. I just happen to have four copies of the bill already drafted to do that, but I did not drop it in because I thought I would come to this committee with some amendments to this bill to work in just exactly what Representative Wolfer's talking about. And I'm not trying to coin a name for anti-collective bargaining disruptor or whatever it was, but I would have to totally agree that the only way I could support this bill against professional strike breakers is if it also included professional tickets.
Do you have amendments to this?
Well, the amendments are being drafted now. I'm trying to convert the bill that I had into amendments for this bill, but they're not ready yet.
I have a concern, too, in regards to the newspaper. Does an exposure that he can see that a misdemeanor fine up to $1,000? Does he really know that he is advertising for a professional strike breaker? In other words, that's an exposure to a newspaper.
Yeah.
And I think what you didn't think about this.
Where?
Because he's been in another party to this.
Where does this bill even refer to this? Fine for newspapers?
Well, I'm no legal, so I can't tell you other than
well,
than the
I'm
section 4.
I'm not either, but I have asked legal beagles, and they say there isn't any such worry in this bill. It doesn't, wouldn't, there's no way it could possibly affect the employer.
In other words,
that's
the only exposure would be to the employer.
Yeah.
If there's a concerted judgment, then we don't have to worry about the newspaper.
And the concerted judgment of the lawyers I have talked to. Let's put it that way. That's right. John just reminded me. You remember when we had the newspaper people here, they said that they would immediately have, if after they checked with their legal staff, if there was any concern for them, they would have some amendments to it. We never received it. Well, evidently, there wasn't any big concern. I think that's a message.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Willard.
Well, is this the question that Representative Moyes is getting at? I missed part of it, but are we talking about how it would affect the Oregonian in this case at the present time?
I'm just concerned about an exposure that they may have to the civil fund.
Because if they added that.
But apparently, Chairman is saying that there is no problem.
Okay, under this law, would the people presently working at the Oregonian in any way be construed to still be strike rate?
No.
They wouldn't?
No, they have to do it third time in the last 5 years.
Oh, in the last 5 years?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, exactly.
Yeah, 76 anyway, but see that the way this is written, they have to go into plant that's on strike twice, and the third time around, they have to strike it.
Hasn't happened in the last 5 years.
Yeah, it's been the last 5 years.
I would say something, if I may, about the concept of a strike breaker and a process. And I don't know and have never seen in my labor career a professional ticket. I've never run into one. There may be, but I have never run into one personally. I've walked a few ticket lines. I walked one for 134 days, not too long ago. And in that time, the only pay I received was something that we had in our strike fund that amounted to, I think, over the 134 days, $50 or $70. But I think we're talking about two different things. Strike breaker, a professional strike breaker, is a vicious being. They go a long way toward subverting labor negotiations, toward creating hostility between employer and employee. They're barracudas. I can't think of the proper terms that I could use in relation to a professional strike breaker. They prey upon the plight of others. And I have no sympathy whatsoever. The chairman stated that this bill didn't do much in relationship to the use of strike breakers. And I have to agree with that, but at least it is something. It prohibits knowingly advertising for or using professional strike breakers. And you only become a professional after you've done so three times in a certain period of time.
For the same company.
Pardon?
Or the same company, right? Or just
three times. Right. And they have done this. This is the case. We saw this quite a few years ago in Portland. And I was about run over by one of these professional strike breakers while I was on a picket line. In their car, crashed through the line. There were people hurt in that. So I have no sympathy whatsoever. Now, you talk about a professional ticket. It's someone who walks back and forth at a gate or in front of a store or something.
And does the same beating up people who
doesn't. I disagree with you 100%.
Well, I didn't disagree, but it occurred. You cannot say the flavor is blue and white.
Representative Holford, if you can name one instance, state of Oregon in recent history where a professional ticket has beat up anybody.
Okay, state of Oregon, okay, then you're safe, but there are other places in this country, and we're beginning to acquire their characteristics as in-migration occurs, and it will only be a matter of time.
I disagree with you, because I think that labor in the state of Oregon is much more sophisticated than that.
That's
I have more and more faith in the labor movement.
Representative Wilson, was that the question?
Yeah.
My knowledge of the professional strike breaker, to say the least, is limited. professional strike breaker. I've been very smooth and very cool. How are you going to prove, one, that I've been to three places? How are you going to prove it? I'm just asking.
Oh, can I prove it? I'm sure that you find that these people, in many cases, are documented, and that there's a track kept on them by maybe the unions themselves or other police agencies to a degree. In California, they've had problems with the use of in some of the other states. And in many cases, they have police records because of the involvement that they've been in labor disputes, and they have acquired police records.
Okay, let's just for the sake of illustration, because again, I want to clarify my own mind. I'm hanging around, I don't have anything to do, and I need a job, so I can take on a professional strike break. My first time out, and I cross the picket line, and I go in and I do my thing. Am I probably going to be identified that first time I cross the picket line? Well, you don't know me from Adam. You don't know if I'm a special strike maker or just some guy who needs a job. Am I probably going to get my picture taken and identified?
I don't know if it would.
And then is that file going to travel across the country?
No, I don't know that it would.
Then how are you going to identify it?
Possibly not in the case that you're talking about.
Okay, but then I do it here in Salem, Oregon, and then I cut out and I do it in Rockford, Maine. Now, how are you going to identify it? See what I'm trying to say?
Right.
And there's going to have to be a file that travels.
Same problem that might happen with a burglar or anybody else.
But I think...
that how do you identify them? They may commit
crime
here and move on. I agree with you. It's a problem. But then I don't think that's the problem that we're faced with here. It doesn't deal with identification. That would be up to other people. And I think we're talking about professional strike breakers.
Okay, let me ask you one other question. Section 2, line 29, no employer shall. Line 30, knowingly. How are you going to find the word knowingly?
Well,
I'm an employer and I hire a professional strike breaker. And I'm going to tell you, I didn't know you were a professional strike breaker.
Well,
now how are you going to define that term?
Well, I think. Someplace along the line, I think maybe this case can be proven. I'm not sure. But I think, too, that I don't really feel that employers are as bad as all this. Maybe we need to say, you know, that they wouldn't knowingly. I don't know. Knowingly is maybe a cop-up.
Or subject to change.
Pardon?
Or subject to change or deletion.
Well, I don't know how you would...
I think
you would rip off some of the hardest that you did.
Representative Reichen?
I think in the case like you just mentioned, I think if the employer was asking, hey, buddy, you know, this is my business.
I don't know. I'm
sure. That's the sure thing they ask you. If a plant is on fire.
No, it says knowingly utilize any professional strike breaker.
But the first thing what the employer would ask a man who applied for a job is, do you know that there is a strike on?
Absolutely. Well, we're talking about suddenly being exposed to a fine of $1,000, then we're going to start talking differently.
And another thing is, like you said, how do they identify this man? Mm-hmm. I think that if a mill is shut down and there are people on strike, and a guy walks in there and applies for a job, that labor itself will probably tell them, you know, they're on strike, if he doesn't realize it, and they'll identify this man, they'll probably ask him, where do you live? What do you do?
Then he gets identified and then the file starts traveling. It has to be stored to identify. Right?
Possibly.
I haven't said it's wrong. I haven't said it's wrong.
Possibly. Because I think that the union involved like to know, you know, what they're doing.
That's true.
Representative Davis? Yeah, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to ask you another question. I think Neil asked it to our administrative assistant or just any of the other committee members. In regards to when the telephone company, when they have a strike, right now they'll hire outside employees, and I guess you could say the strike breakers, to operate the phone facilities. And I'm not just talking about supervisory help, which is exempt from organized groups anyway. But I understand they hire people on the outside, and I guess you call them strike breakers, to keep the phone equipment going, because you know we can't do without phones in the state. And is this bill saying that the phone company can no longer
hire outside employees?
They'll tell us they don't have approximately 700 people that belong, that aren't supervisors, that don't belong to the...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I don't know if the representative trying to pull my chain or not. But I can make a flat statement that the Mother Bell, in any stripe in the last 18 years in this state, has never hired any outside help. I can't account for the time before my employment with them, but they do not employ special strike workers. They utilize management employees, and the management employees are, of course, exempt in this
They have 700, a little over 700 employees that are not in a union themselves, that are not managed classified personnel, too.
All true.
Within the system that they use. Now, what they do, I don't know. But that was the figure they gave.
Well, they don't hire outside.
Well, I was told, just this morning I came upon this information, they told me my telephone person came to my office and said, hey, how about the people we hire when we're out on strike?
Don't they transfer these people?
Well, I would submit to you that the person who gave you that information is grossly misled, Representative Davis.
Okay, Betty Rogers.
I'm going to talk about this same section 2, you know, here, 2930, subsection 1. I think that this places an undue burden on an employer because if a strike should occur in a place of business, and when he does hire someone, regardless of how he hires that person or from what sort, then if the charge is filed, if that person is a professional strike maker, it's going to place the burden upon that employer to disprove it. I think that this is an unfair advantage because we have in this state many, many small employers. And this is going to cause them to wind up in court defending themselves. And then, if this is a false charge, then it's spending a lot of time and a lot of money.
Of course, I guess it's the way you read things, but I read it just exactly the opposite. I think it gives the employer a complete out. Right. The courts are going to have to prove it. He knows this, that he's okay.
But
they're not even going to try. Right?
But he does. He could wind up in court if this charge is filed.
Oh, likely. But the thing is, law enforcement agencies aren't going to spend that much money trying to prove that.
I would certainly agree to strike knowingly.
I would too, frankly, because I think that's more of an out for the employer than it is for the employee. I think it gives them a complete out. That's what I said. I don't know why anybody really cares where the bill goes
back,
on. Because it doesn't do anything.
The point is if a motion was in order,
I'm taking that one.
I would move to strike knowingly.
Oh,
my heart has been cut.
You heard the motion. Any discussion on that motion?
First, striking section 2.
Book of strike regulation.
Strike knowingly. Line 30.
Strike knowingly?
Yeah. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I'm simply going to be unable to support this proposal. And I can't support the bill. I would like to support the bill, but I will not be able to when you strike that word. Suddenly, you're placing the burden of proof upon the employer, and I really wonder if that's an honest approach.
I think it is, Mr. Judge. Usually, if an employer hires a man, they usually know where the man comes from, what he did, what he's doing, and so forth.
Well, that's the judge's decision, too.
Absolutely correct, because if you, any mill, I've seen, my experience is, if you apply for a job in a mill, they know exactly your background and life.
Any further discussion, Chairman?
Representative Davis.
In rebuttal of this, Representative Rankin, I don't think sometimes an employer knows whether or not that some employee, a potential employee, strike breaker, not is a beneficial strike breaker. For example, a good example is in the service station business where someone will come in off the street and the manager might be looking for someone to work for a few days and whatnot, and he'll just go ahead and hire them on. Love service station. And I think it relates to other businesses too. A lot of times a manager won't check references in the type of business that doesn't require a great deal of skill.
Man lies
too. I mean, I think it's a very complex problem.
Well, I think we have to really deal with this whole thing of professional strike breakers. That's what we're talking about. The professional strike breakers. And no one who would use these people wouldn't know who they were. They're used for that reason and reason only. And I think this is what we're talking about in this bill, is the use of professional strike breakers. Now, my motion to delete the word knowingly was to maybe bring out some of the points here. As I said before, I agree with the chairman that the bill doesn't do all that much. And if there was some way that I felt that we could get a bill that would absolutely prohibit the use of professional strike breakers 100%, I certainly would support that. I've seen the use of them in the past and how vicious something like this can be. Because professional strike breakers isn't just someone who comes in to fill a job during an interim period. Professional strike breakers use is to destroy the strike. And that's it. It's to do away with the process, the only weapon that the working man has, and that's the strike. And I think if you bear that in mind, that you can see that maybe there is merit in this. And I appeal to that.
Good Tim.
Representative Rogers.
I'd like to ask a question of Representative Seth.
Sure.
What you're really saying with that statement is that if you could get a law through to say this, that no place of business that was under strike could be left open. Is that correct?
No, not at all. No, because I see how to differentiate between the strike breaker and supervisory help, which this bill does, and any other. We find in many businesses, and in fact, I think the state maybe has even referred employment office this time from time to time, has referred people to companies that are on strike. The bill is dealing with professional strike breakers. I don't think you want to forget that term, professional. As I say, I would bring out some of my own personal feelings, Representative Rogers, as to the use of these, because I've seen them used in the past. And there are such things as harmonious strikes, where differences cannot be resolved other than through a strike, or in some cases even a lockout. And so the two parties, employer and employee, come to a point where they cannot agree, and the only weapon for the employee is to walk out, to go on strike, to hit the brick. This is their only weapon. And right now, there are so many laws in existence that limit what they can do there, that many of their strengths are taken away. And I have seen time and again employers, employees, standing together on a picket line, laughing and joking and talking about their kids and fishing trips and so on and so forth, and realizing that they have differences, and realizing that this was the only way maybe that they could finally say, okay, let's get together. I've been out on the bricks long enough, you've been out of business long enough, let's get together and talk about this thing and settle our differences. And they do. But when you throw in a wedge like a professional strike breaker, or use these people, that split becomes wider and wider and wider, and hostilities rise, and many, many times blood flows. And sometimes those wounds are never healed. End of speech.
I didn't expect that one. When I asked the question, I thought you made the statement that if you had your rhythm, obviously you would do away with track breakers. Now, isn't someone coming off the street to look for a guy in effect with track breakers? Okay, that's what you said. We've had quite a bit of motion testimony here about the many, many times on all these occurrences that require the need for this law because of the use of these people. Does this committee have any documented evidence of such use of these people?
Documented, not within the committee. We know it's happened. We have in Oregonian, it happened in Longshore Strike.
I don't know this. You know,
well,
because there are two versions to all stories, and this is why I think, do we have concrete evidence that this has happened? Because I'm not going to stand up and say many times these tickets are thrown brick through windows, which we all know has happened also.
Yeah.
And so there is obviously some bad on both sides. We're only hearing about all these instances, and I haven't seen any documented.
Well, we don't have it here, but it has happened in those two cases. That's the only two cases I know of that state of Oregon. That's not saying there hasn't been others. Anything further on we're discussing now? You're leaving the word noise, not the bill.
Chairman?
Representative Moore.
The one thing, Representative Crest, that continues to bother me, you painted earlier a picture of the professional strike breaker and pretty dark, dismal, barracuda type individual. I really wonder if he will be honest with the employer and identify himself. I think to solve a problem, and there is a problem, you swayed me with your comment, there's a problem to solve. Let's solve it being fair and equitable to both sides. And I think the striking of the word knowingly is not being fair to both sides. I would call for the question of the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, your motion, you have a final say. I'd like to, if I may, withdraw my motion.
Any objection?
No.
Withdrawn.
Chairman?
Yes.
I would move that the House Bill 2157 to the floor of the Dispatch Committee.
No, it's already been done.
Okay.
That's been requested. That's to start with.
Okay.
Any further discussion?
Well, yeah, Mr. Chairman, I haven't got anything against an anti-strike breaker bill as such. But I have to agree with Representative Wolf that I think it would be I think it would be a credit to this committee, as a matter of fact, if we expanded this bill to include, I don't know if the word professional ticket is proper or not, but to try to pass out a bill which would help keep the peace during a labor dispute on both sides, preventing the use of a strike breaker, preventing the use of outside tickets. So if you don't want to call them pros, fine. But something that's always bothered me is the shifting of tickets from one area to another, and that could be done. A local union might encompass the West Coast, and you could transfer a ticket from San Francisco to Seattle, or from Portland to Klamath Falls, or whatever the case might be. And that in itself creates hostility. Now, it may not be a professional ticket, but the fact that they're not a local ticket creates hostility. And you talk about blood flowing. Well, I imagine some blood has flown, and probably will continue to.
Klamath County, you said.
Well, the Klamath County labor negotiations are really very peaceful, and we've had our problems, but I don't think we've had the problems that they've had in the city of Portland, the Tri-County area.
I was referring to labor.
Oh. Oh, this is a labor. But in any event, I could certainly support a bill that we would put out of this committee that would, in effect, keep the peace and labor negotiations, but it's going to be limited strictly to the special strike breakers, as it is in its present form. I can't support it.
Did you say you had a bill drawn up?
Well, yes, Mr. Chairman, but I, rather than introduce the bill as such, I would rather have, like I say, I'm in the process of having the amendments drafted now. I would rather have amendments drafted for this existing bill rather than put this bill in, because if, frankly, if this bill goes in, there's going to be a lot of people going to see red. You may be one of them.
Yeah.
But because the bill itself just deals with professional pickets, and I am not proposing that we deal only with professional pickets or out-of-town pickets and not with strike breakers. I'm proposing that if we do something, we deal with them both together. And I think it would be a responsible thing for this committee to do, as a matter of fact. But so I would not want to submit this bill as such as a committee bill.
Frankly, I understand what you're talking about. We also have to start getting some action out of this committee.
Well, there's not several other bills left today.
Well, we have a motion on the floor, though, so we're going to have to take a vote on it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, please believe me that I am not bringing this up in an effort to stall this bill. I don't want to see this bill pass in present form, make no mistake about it. But the reason that I bring this up is that I'm sincere in saying that I think it would be a credit to this committee if we did pass out a bill.
How long before your amendments get out?
Well, I'm sure that we could expedite the drafting of the amendments.
Could we, Mr. Chairman, maybe have somebody work on this morning and we can consider later stuff?
I don't know if we could expedite on that.
Call LC and tell him, or whoever's doing it, tell him we've got to be done by 1 o'clock.
That's any credit.
Well, I think that when we get into this yeah. other area, myself would like to hear some testimony on that particular subject. As I stated earlier, that in my limited career, I have never seen the employment of professional or whatever quote unquote picketers, and I would like to hear some testimony on this from several sources, employers, labor unions, whatever. And I think that this is going to delay Council 2157. And I'd like to see us proceed with this, and then give Representative Bono the mic to introduce the bill for the committee. I would support the introduction of it as far as the committee bill, so they can get a fair and just hearing.
Mr. Chairman, I kind of have problems along with Gary on the equity part of it, but I'd be quite willing to vote for a bill that says can't even, you can't do a strike breaker once and you can't do it again unless you're in business employment or something like that. If we say, for example, in 656 or somewhere, where unions have one advantage and a tremendous advantage over the business, and that they're exempt from antitrust law, which creates a good, and perhaps good reason for it. But I think that the unions have in a number of cases, and perhaps not in Oregon, and I know this law only will affect Oregon, have a tremendous advantage in that regard. And that unless that is balanced, I don't think and I can foresee a time when as Oregon gets larger and more people and industry gets larger and everything, that we'll be more like the industrial eastern states where they have had problems with this type of thing, where I think definitely that the unions definitely have the upper hand on the businesses in a number of industries, and I don't think that that's fair either. I think it should be close to even as one can make it, and for that reason, I can't support it unless it provides a certain amount of balance, or secondly, that we're losing something up on the other side that balances it off of business. And if we do something like that, I'm willing to give you the tightest strike rate, vote for the tightest strike rate you want. I mean, you just name it, type thing. As long as, I guess what I'm saying is just the balance, and I think that just the intent or whatever the legislature is going the other direction, I mean, just isn't there.
I agree that it's under stress. I think we should pursue this. And if you want to talk about the
introducing a bill in regard to vacant, it should be a different thing. Because it's a different thing. Because the intent of this bill is to break the strike. The pickets don't break the strike.
No, but they bring business on occasion.
No.
What's wrong? I mean, what? How is
on
that
occasion?
Different?
Yes. On occasion, no
business.
On occasion.
A man works his whole life, 40 years, and makes
yes,
a man.
Wait, now just simmer down, simmer down. On occasion, a mill shuts down because they say they have overstocked or, you know, any reason, and we can shut down. We don't know. We cannot control. The people who work there cannot control it, but they do. It's being done in the past, in paper one.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wolfer, I think that's something to say now.
Well, I just want to say there has been a case, and I'm not saying it's happened in Oregon, where a union has gone in and gone against the company and attempted to destroy it, and in fact has. I would think it would be better. I would like to make a motion to move this bill to time certain in our afternoon session, say 2 o'clock. And I'd like to make that motion. And then maybe we can have the amendment ready at that time.
What time? Before 11?
10:30.
10:30. Or 3 o'clock.
You got if you want a time to get yes, to go to three.
Okay, I would then.
You got a caucus to do.
Pardon?
Okay, caucus to do.
Well, we move time first, it's always in order, so.
Question?
Agnes?
What is it? You're voting for this bill now?
Voting for time?
No. Time
for time.
For time, 3 o'clock.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. 3 o'clock. We go in at 10:30?
Yeah.
Put together 11 o'clock.
We can make it.
Is that your directive, Mr. Chairman?
Well, got 11 o'clock.
Let's see what we have next, see whether we have time or not. I yeah, this is Kalinowski bill. Yeah. I would suggest this is how we go in and we hope not start on the next bill by our pushes. We're not gonna set a time schedule on those sessions anymore. That we adjourn until 1:30.
I think that was.
Are you red
eye? House Labor Committee come to order again. We'll start in on 2192.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
Mr. Chairman?
We don't want
public employee retirement system. because it serves no real purpose. They're designated as temporary employees. That's the federal law setting this program up. Recognizes this as such. Under our state law, these people would be required to have deducted after 6 months the amount of TERF. And then, of course, they want to terminate it, they would get that money back. But then it keeps them from having the dollars to spend during that period of time.
I might think it's going to be worse than that hour than it is right now.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
How are we doing with the feds on this kind of proposal?
I'm just going to have to leave that. He's sitting right there.
How does this proposed amendment conform with the Fed? You know, they get excited about sometimes when we do things.
Being that was just the same with the TERF program, I don't think it would be fair to get any interpretation of how it was there. I'm just looking at the state of the nation.
I'm a moment so didn't you tell me that we can pass it, but legally we can't do it right now because of federal regulations?
There
I mean the bill itself, not the amendment.
The bill itself had to be amended, or at least we thought it should be amended, to exclude the emergency jobs and unemployment assistance act of 1974. But in the rest of it would have been acceptable for you.
These are Title I.
All the
Title I's right. All left.
All the work training, work experience, work study programs are going to be primarily oriented.
This 237.003 is the definition for the public employee's retirement. Now, in the federal rules and regulations, and jumping back and forth through here, we read them, it says that expenditures may be made from these funds for payments to this, but it doesn't say they have to be in this one particular set of rules.
Am I looking at a different bill? Your amendment says Section 4, and I don't even have a Section 4.
Right, this would be an additional.
Addition to
right.
The Section 4.
Add a new section. Okay.
All right. This isn't Title I people.
Title VI people are employed under the provisions of Title II.
Well, I mean, as long as we amend out the everybody with Title I, we can still put in the pension deal. The amendment.
Representative Whalen, I just given Representative Rogers here the public law 93, I think it's 373. This is the Basic Comprehensive Employment Training Act of 1973. Now then, when you get into Title VI, they're saying in Title VI, which is part of this Emergency Jobs and Unemployment Assistance Act, they're saying that those people are entitled to the same conditions of employment, which the Comprehensive Employment Training Act requires. And that paragraph there seems to cover the subject.
Yeah, but how about the Title I people?
Title I are not, there's no problem there.
Because that's all this bill covers, and that's Title I. So
in its present form.
We put the amendment in, it isn't even effective, because the bill is only Title I people. I think we did accept that amendment, I remember.
But if you add Title VI people into the PERS, in other words, if you exclude them from that, well, then you create another possible problem.
Now, well, there's no problem. No, the amendment will just speak to this people that are covering the bill, Title I people.
No, this amendment here would just speak to the Title VI people. The bill basically, as it stands now, speaks to the Title I people.
Yeah.
Here is an amendment that would bring in the people on the Title VI for this particular section. The rest of the bill in sections one, the first three sections, would not apply to the Title VI. They apply to Title I.
Title I only. This is Title VI.
This is an attempt to give.
But that says we can't do it, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know.
If they have to have all the same conditions as ordinary employees, they can't.
Seeing the
regardless of what their language is.
Right. The Department of Labor administrative rules here, what we're looking at.
What does the Attorney General's office think? You don't think?
Well, I looked this up the other day, and that's one of the reasons why I leave that out. Might as well be a manager in the bill. And, well, I think the federal law would require that they give them all the same benefits as other employees.
Which means
whether or not they're still provided in their regulations, I'm not sure. It's certainly there in the law.
Which means we can't do it. After you get through talking, says we can't do it because otherwise they won't give us a seat of fun.
Could be the end result.
Of course, you didn't move to accept it yet.
No, I'm just leaving that passing around. Because I would have done that if I hadn't thought we were pretty well set on the bill itself.
Where did you come from?
From Gary Carlson. So would you like to ask Gary?
Yeah.
Our interest in this change is to accommodate the problem of having strictly temporary employees under Title VI, which is an emergency kind of employment situation, receive the maximum benefit in terms of dollars received to them, spendable income, and not have to come under that 600-hour rule under the PERS law. Our feeling is that situation of interpretation of the law and regulations for Title VI have some language which appears to us to be more broad in terms of retirement benefits, indicating that they're allowed but they're not required for Title VI employees. And I guess looking at the range of seated employees, we see a fallacy here in that City of Salem, for instance, has their Title VI employees on temporary payroll. they are ineligible for the city's private retirement system entirely. The city of Eugene is under BDRS as their final six employees on temporary payroll. After 600 hours work, they automatically must come under BDRS, and the city must take away 4, 5, or 6% of their income after 600 hours. And the city must make a contribution for that employee to the system, which obviously can't be recovered. That's our position on it. We feel it isn't an issue of interpretation. And frankly, we'd like to see a definitive ruling if it's that much of an issue as to whether or not we'd be eligible for CETA funds. We don't feel like it is.
I'm not too sure, though, we'd be better off if we went a separate route, not jeopardize one for the other. See what I mean?
I'm sorry.
Put this through as a committee bill on its own merits rather than jeopardize 2192 in case we can't do it.
That would be fine, Your Honor.
I wouldn't have any objections to draw it up and drop it as a committee bill.
That
way we wouldn't, you know. But if we dumped it in here, the lab would throw the whole thing out. We don't want to do that.
No.
I don't think. You can kind of get that drafted up in
separate bill.
Yeah, separate bill.
I think there's a chance of us getting some kind of an answer that from the federal people on this before we actually come to a hearing.
Well, I think we should write a letter and ask them.
We've got a lot of tough issues.
Well, I think we should certainly write a letter and ask. Fully intended that John will end up doing that before we, you know, if we get that drawn up, find out just exactly their interpretation. But anything else on 2192? I hear Representative Davis moves the floor to do pass as amended.
Yes, sir, do.
Okay. For the motion, any more on the question? I think we'll have a call.
Aye.
Would you like to handle that, Drew? You might as well
start it.
That's what I was going
to say. You see the gentleman right there in red tie?
Yep.
He's your man.
You can't read.
Boy, everybody else does.
It's again the rule. Of course, you that ever stop.
Hold on. 2206.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Do we have any indication of the financial impact on the unemployment fund? This legislation?
No. There's an impact statement back right in your deal. It says effect on revenue, none. Effect on expenditures, slight increase.
Not the back of mine.
Did you look at
that? I can read yours.
Now, I'll tell you what it says. From the Employment Division, effect on revenue, none. Effect on expenditures, Employment Division projects the passage of HB 2206 to result in a slight increase in expenditures, but estimates the expenditures to be insignificant. Reviewed and approved by Legislative Fiscal Office, Brooklyn. February 17th, 75. further discussion on that one? Lee?
There would be some problems with administering the law of this veteran as far as the actual effect. They really didn't have too much information to base it on the cost of the term of total payout.
You're guessing, in other words.
The part of the administration.
That was intended to be there.
Because I remember saying, Wilhelm asked for the original something on the employment.
Yeah, the employment division was going to bring that over. And I called, like, the second drop meeting. Okay, I said, it should be there. I told him before, I don't know whether they took it yet. And then it was Wilhelm to whether they didn't get it over there. He had asked for the original draft of the original bill, about four paragraphs long. I don't know if he, I think his concern was the intent of unemployment insurance was reviewed in 1937.
The original unemployment law.
And some of them coming over at either the last hearing or this hearing, and it looked pretty good, and I didn't get it.
Sorry, we wasn't aware of the request, but we certainly have to apply. The request is for a copy of the original unemployment insurance act that was enacted in Oregon.
Yes. It was philosophical.
Yes.
Chairman, I would be interested in what it said myself.
Are you suggesting we set this over to get it?
But you keep doing it, and doing it.
That's right.
Or maybe that would be better than doing stuff.
I can get a copy of the written law that we have either picked up, brought over, or leave it over again.
Why don't we do that? Because Gary isn't here yet anyway, and he won't be here for a little bit. If you can make a call and have somebody push him over. Why don't we do that? We don't have any motion. We'll just set that aside temporarily. And we'll get to
the bottom of the pocket.
They're going to get it.
Yeah,
Mr. Morgan's secretary told me they were writing a short history of unemployment compensation, and that's why she happened to know that it was available. But she had just seen it recently, and that was to be sent over.
2211. Fiscal impact in years on this one?
Yeah, I'd like to see it. Huh? I don't have it.
Neither do I.
Well, evidently I'm the only fortunate one. You ready again?
All right.
Effect on revenue. Employment division estimates the reduction in tax revenue amount is indeterminate. Expenditures. The division estimates additional expenditures from the trust fund of $7 million during the 1975-77 biennium and increases in administrative expenditures estimated at $46,000 during the 75-77.
Did I hear you say $7
million? Yeah. You heard me exactly right.
Thank you.
And Wilkinson was tip off on this too. There he comes.
Mm-hmm. It didn't go past how much it was.
What's 46,000?
What's 46,000?
Administrative expense.
With the press comment?
Did you hear it?
Yeah.
You haven't been through this. Did you hear it?
No. Did you hear it, press?
Yeah, it was there.
I think you told us. I was so excited when they passed my bill out. Copy of this, or do we already have the full
text? No, we did not have a copy of the prior
one section of the bill says for the purposes of chapter 667 set payments for vacation pay and so forth would not be considered wages under the employment division law. Therefore they would not be reportable, and truly they would not be a deductible item as far as future claims are concerned, but in future periods they would not even be wages for the base of future claim law.
That's new language in chapter 5.
Now those cost impact figures are based on some assumptions. We know how many people are disqualified from receipt of unemployment benefits because of some sort of deduction. How much of it is divided by household money to the revenue. It was just based more or less on educated guess, assuming about 80% of them are vacation pay, holiday pay, that rate, and further assuming quite a number of people do not even file benefits because of the holiday pay.
I have a note here that says may conflict with 657-205A.
Check that out and see what's there. I talked to legislative council about that, and they just said don't worry about it for now, as far as passing the bill, not starting.
Oh.
We'll pick that up.
All right.
Chairman?
Yes.
It seems to me like when we had testimony, at the hearing we had a couple of weeks ago, that there was a specific problem alluded to here in the Salem area. Mr. Day is here. I wonder if he could possibly relate the specific problem that we're trying to address here.
All right.
One of the specific problems we're trying to address.
Thanks very much.
Basically, this bill would go a lot farther than the problem that we were faced with as far as the... My name is L.D. Day, and I represent the Joint Council of Teamsters 37, here on behalf of House Bill 2211. The basic problem that we were faced with is that we had a season. We are on a seasonal basis. The season was ending, and the people had been laid off on a temporary basis. This was in a cherry operation. And we actually received these cherries somewhere in the first week in July or the last week in June. And we put these in brine, and we brine these cherries, and in approximately 5 weeks or so, we then bring them out and start processing. But the net effect of this story is that these people were laid off somewhere the latter part of May, and they were asked to stand by on call for work. And though, even though they had vacation coming, they were asked not to take it at that time and to stand by so that when the brining started, they could call him in for this 10-day period where they placed these cherries in the brine, and then they would be allowed to go ahead with their vacation. The employees then agreed to do that and did stand by on call, and you can't just predict which day or which week you're going to start your cherry grinding operation. As a result of this, they were denied unemployment during that period of time they were standing by, and the net effect of what I would like to see you accomplish in this particular bill is that the people, if they had vacation coming and were indeed accommodating their employer and standing by to be called in for work, that they would not be denied unemployment because they had the vacation pending when it was on the request of the employer to not use it. That was our problem, and that's where we lost our case in the Circuit Court of Appeals. And that was the crux of this particular bill. And I agree, if you read this, you're talking about severance and several other matters. The matter that we lost it on was on the vacation pay, and that was the fact situation that we were concerned about. We just don't believe it's fair to have someone, you could carry that to any extent, employer could say, well, look, we don't want you to take your vacation for 3 months and deny that individual any right to take or to have unemployment benefits under the way it's done right now. That was our problem.
Mr.
Chairman?
Sure.
They were actually laid off during this waiting period. They were denied benefits during this period of time because they still had vacation pay coming.
Yes.
That they could have theoretically taken during that time.
And would have taken if they hadn't been requested not to take it and go on vacation. See, some of these people may have had 3 weeks vacation, Representative Wilhelm, and they didn't take it simply because the company involved wanted them to be available when the cherries came. As soon as the cherries came in, the brine season was over, they then went ahead and took it. But they were denied 3 weeks of unemployment because they take the cherries, they had vacation pending.
What happened then after they finished the brining operation, and I assume they were out of work again?
Yes, right. And then they went ahead and drew their unemployment. The contention is though that they should have been eligible for the unemployment compensation during that 3 week period they were standing by. That's the point. Even though they had vacation pending, It was at the request of the employer that they be available and not go on vacation, not of their own choice. They could have, some of them would have indeed taken their vacation during that period, but it was through the accommodation the employer they were available. And they were denied simply because vacation was pending.
And they had to take their vacation they had coming after.
That's right.
When they were laid off before they could start drawing benefits, then.
That's right.
After.
Yeah, that's right. And there was no problem there because they all went ahead and took their vacation. That wasn't really the issue. The issue wasn't the fact that they wouldn't have taken their vacation sooner. But I thought it was rather remarkable that if you carried that to the furthest extent, an employer could withhold vacation and almost to keep someone ineligible from drawing unemployment if he did it correctly. And the test being, were they available and in the labor market? And the answer, yes, they were. But they were still denied, even in the Circuit Court of Appeals, because we took the case to the Circuit Court of Appeals because of the nature of it. No, they weren't. They were available. They were in the labor market. And it was at the request of the employer that they did not go ahead and take their vacation. But the way the law is now, they can deny it.
It's not a question, it's kind of just theoretical example. Let's say they're off in about, you know, a week, and then someone says, well, here's a job, you know, the employment division says, yeah, we got a job for you, you know, you're trained, qualified, et cetera, et cetera. Then they were in a position where these individuals were going to take that job.
Well, you have a separate set of rules that apply in the fact situation you're giving. If they were on call by some other, by their employer, and they're asked to stand by, it'd be highly unlikely that the employment service would, under those circumstances, dispatch them to some other job. But if they were called under those circumstances and they'd been laid off in its entirety, yes, then they would could be called to other work.
Well, if I understand the way the statutes work, is that you have to be actively seeking employment and be willing to take it.
Right.
And like in the case of a student or something, there may be no job, but he's got to be willing to get
out. Students can't draw on unemployment anyway.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
But I'm just saying that's kind of the philosophy behind that.
That's right.
I'm trying to find out what's the, you know, where you're at, and
well,
in regard to that kind of definition being out actively seeking employment.
Well, they were actively, I guess what I tried to say, there was no other employment in the area. We don't start. The earliest work that we really had, where anybody would be called at that time, would be in the strawberries, and it's rather limited because of the high seniority that's called for that work. But in answer to your question, the net effect here was that they wouldn't have been drawing. In other words, we might have had on June 1, if they were, let's say they were laid off on June 1, and they had vacation coming, they would have taken their vacation if they could have. But the employer went to them and said, look, we do not want you to take your vacation now because we want you to be standing by because we may indeed need to call you in somewhere in the second or third week in June to help in the brining season. They accepted that, did not go ahead and take their vacation, and they were actively available for work and seeking.
Yeah, okay, well, then what I'm really saying is these people are kind of waiting for it to happen. So I guess what I'm trying to get down to is then really it's whether it's the state's obligation or the company's obligation to pay these people during this period when the company wants them on call. And that's really what it comes down to, isn't it?
Well,
whether the unemployment fund should pay it or whether the employer
should
pay it.
Well, of course, I guess what it really comes down to is were they laid off? And were they available for work? And the test was they were available for work, and they certainly were in the labor market, and if they had been offered other work and the employer had not put strings on their call, when they would have been taken to work. So I don't, the idea they pay into the unemployment fund like anyone else, I would assume the employee should be entitled to.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question for the employment division. How many dollars, service dollars, in the cannery business, food processing, like canneries, that every dollar the employer pays in that is paid out? What's the ratio on that?
John Deere 1973, about $2.5
million
of dollars in tax collection, about $3.7
million in benefit payments. Will the
cannabis be higher or lower? Cannabis would be higher. I mean, as I recall, they were about $1.50
in benefits,
$1.50
tax. Okay, thank you.
Anybody else have any?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Now what? Wait a minute. You got the bill there?
Nope.
Employment Division seems to think they'll have a problem with.
I beg your pardon?
Employment Division seems to think they'll have a problem with page 3, section 5. Sub 5. Now, mainly because they won't be collecting any money from these people where they do now right now.
Well, I guess what I. When you get to severance benefits and some of the other items, I'm not necessarily going to be supportive of that particular effort. What I was trying to get at is a specific problem. When someone has earned a vacation and they are asked by their employer to not take that vacation at that time and hold them available, hold themselves available for the workforce, that I don't think they should be denied unemployment. Now, the point is the employer is still going to pay the tax. I mean, the tax is going to pay, and sooner or later they're still going to draw their benefit. I just don't believe, though, that it's fair to penalize them when, in fact, they're holding themselves available for the workforce. That's the issue there. I'm not, they may have a particular problem with some other parts of the language, and I don't know, and I'm not speaking to separate.
This is new language.
I know it's new language. What this really is trying to say, as I understand it here, is anytime you want to amend the law, they always put a notwithstanding and allow the catch-all phrases. And what they're, I think they're including sick pay, holiday pay, earned, served, performed prior to termination of employment, and so on, is considered wages for compensation of personal service under the chapter. Well, there are a lot of other benefits that may be paid that would not fit the fact situation that I'm talking about, because if you're terminated, and so forth, that those are paid really when you leave the job, and I don't think anyone, I mean, you ought to be able to draw those first and then serve your waiting week after you receive those benefits, at least in my opinion. Now, I'm not speaking for others, but I think the vacation situation that I'm giving you under, if this individual can demonstrate that the employer indeed asked them to stand by, I don't think you ought to be denied unemployment benefits, and I think that's entirely different from the severance benefit or holiday pay earned. That's what I'm trying to say. Maybe I'm not saying it.
Representative Pratt?
Maybe you can explain it to me. Under what circumstances would an employee, upon termination, receive holiday pay or sick pay?
Well, they might have a guaranteed holidays, Jim. They could have so many guaranteed holidays, and they could well be that they're guaranteed even on termination, even though they haven't occurred. They could have guaranteed on an annual basis. Some contracts call for that. In most cases, I'd be the first to admit that they've taken them, unless they haven't taken them and have set them aside, probably be rare. But there are a few cases where you have guaranteed holidays, and if they cross over a certain period, they're going to get 8 days guaranteed just like that.
Yeah. You have to excuse me for my ignorance, but in my industry, we just got paid holidays a year ago.
I understand.
But, I
you got a lot of other good things, though.
That was one question, and of course I can see it in the vacation pay, absolutely, because many industries, like one that do not receive vacation at the time you take it, but they take your vacation any time during the year, and your vacation pay comes around on a given date.
Well, I don't know. I think if this is carried to the fullest extent, it could be used as a denial of unemployment, particularly people involved in wood products industry, anything that's seasonal. It could be a problem for a lot of us. And I think the test is, were those people in the labor market, and were they available for work, and were they seeking work? And if they were, then should they be denied, particularly when the request was really at the accommodation of the employer? And this is what bothered me. I mean, if someone had said, look, I didn't want to take my vacation at a given time, then they make their own choice.
I agree with you on the vacation part. I think we're going much further than that.
I'd be honest with you. I think what I would be here supporting vacation only. I don't want to. This is my bill. I am supportive of the trust, but I must tell you that I think the problem I'm most concerned about is in the vacation situation, and I would be supportive if we could just do that.
Shelby, what about the situation where there was no gap, that person was laid off and had vacation pay coming. How do you feel about them being able to draw that vacation pay and and draw in front of someone.
Oh, I don't feel that's proper either. I think they ought to be able to, they should take their vacation. I'm not advocating that. I think they ought to take their vacation and then serve their waiting week and go from there. Because if they're on vacation, they aren't in the labor force. That's the test.
Right. Well, what kind of, we're looking for some amendments, aren't we, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, John has an idea here. What it works for that one.
Okay.
To cover your situation, Mr. Day, instead of on line 6 of page 3, instead of using termination, and I'm not sure what words we should use, but what about something like temporary layoff? And then have some definition of what a
or on temporary call of the employer.
Yeah, we could have some definition of what put that in. And say that that's where someone has been told they will be, in no doubt, coming back.
Well, I think that maybe the committee should be aware of that House Bill 2491 addresses the same subject, and I think maybe a little cleaner might be on the
We got any kind of bill.
We have
all part of the problem.
We
have that one?
Yeah, this is really very clean.
Where is it?
You have it.
We have it? When did we get that? Huh?
Heard it.
No.
It hasn't been heard yet.
Must have got it Friday.
It was one that you promised they requested about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, we got that Friday. Yeah, the one that I... What, yeah.
2491.
Yeah.
I think 2491
is the subject of 2206. It does. 2211.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's right to the point and would take care of our problem. I don't want to intimate that we were trying to get something when someone's on vacation. All we are trying to do is take care of it. If they're available in the workforce, as Representative Wolfer points out, if we're actually seeing them, we think we ought to be entitled.
I'll tell you what, because we haven't heard this one yet, and we're going to have to, I will accept the motion to table 2211 so we work on the other one.
So moved.
Chairman, 2211 offers the same thing as her.
But as far as intent, from what we've heard today,
we can swing that around when we have a hearing on it, is what I'm getting at. There isn't much obvious work in 2211 if everybody agrees to the language in there.
Well,
in 2491, perhaps it would be better to work on it. What I was thinking.
I just want the intent was, too, though, because there's these other things in everybody's vacation pay.
The sponsor of the bill, he's the one that had them draw this up.
I should tell you, it was at my request the bill was drawn up, and frankly,
that's
it's gone too broadly. That's the point I'm trying to make.
I knew this, that's why I was saying that.
Yeah, 2211 was at my request. Is drawn up, and I don't want to speak for them because they may have some other things in mind, but the purpose that we had requested to be drawn up is spoken to directly in 2491 or whatever the number is, and if you haven't heard a hurry on it, at least I'll testify. You've heard my testimony. I'm okay which number it is, just so we take care of the problem, okay?
Second motion. We've had a motion table, at least we've been discussing, we're not supposed to, so we'll have a vote now.
Aye.
2211 table.
2491, right?
Yes. Who bill is it that I have?
Employment division.
I'm sure I have plenty up there.
Yeah.
Now we'll come to somebody's favorite bill, 2247. Oh my God. Okay, looking around. Starting on 2247, but we have a note here from Jack Kalinowski that says they're working with Employment Division people with an amendment that might make this bill acceptable.
Got some bad bills in here.
What do you know about that one, Lee? What work's being done on 2247 to make it so it works?
I have some material here that I'll hand out and I'll discuss it briefly if you'd like.
It's going to happen. I don't think anything he's going to say is going to make you like it.
My name is Lee Russell and I represent the Employment Division. House Bill 2247 would delete the requirement that an individual have sufficient pay credits for a valid claim, provided the individual is enrolled in an approved limited program of instruction, which does not exceed 30 calendar days in a 12-month period, and the eligible individual would be entitled to the maximum weekly benefit amount, not be required to serve a waiting list. In this respect, would be treated a little differently than other type claimants. While the Employment Division approves and endorses the use of vocational training to provide the training needed to those unemployed individuals who lack necessary skills and so forth, we can see a few problems with the way the bill is drafted in, as far as administration, particularly with regard to the establishment of the maximum weekly benefit amount as the amount payable while the individual is in training. For instance, if we found an individual eligible for benefits of $88 a week at the present time, and he had no wage credits and covered employment, but the bill would give him an $88 weekly benefit amount for a 30-day period, would the establishment of that claim lock that individual in for a benefit year? Maybe 3 months later, the individual might have sufficient wage credit for a valid state claim. And if he was locked into a 4-week period of unemployment benefits at the maximum, for instance, he might not be eligible for the regular claim at a later period of time. Are the benefits paid during this program and limited instruction to be included in the potential amount of benefits payable during the individual's benefit year? For instance, the amendment says notwithstanding, or 657-150, which has all the eligibility and the potential benefit amount payable. What about a partial week of instruction? In other words, the individual is in instruction capacity for 2 days and 3 days, and not 3 days, is to be paid benefit. Is the limited period program instruction mean 30 consecutive days or any 30 days in the calendar year? The provisions of 2247, these training benefits paid while an individual is in training are not, under the current law, are not charged to an employer's account, except if the base period employer happens to be a government or a nonprofit employer. So if one of these individuals happen to be have a base period employer of a government or nonprofit, then of course the government or nonprofit employer would be paying that portion of the cost, because the non-charging provisions of the training section does not apply to the reimbursement type employers. The increased non-charging would add to our socialized costs. At the present time, approximately 21% of the benefits paid are not charged to any individual employer's account. That's up from 7% 10 years ago. And total socialized costs, which includes some ineffective charges, in other words, those employers that their tax payment does not equal the amount of benefits paid to the former employees, that amount has to be picked up by some employers. These total costs represent about 50% of total benefits paid, and they are, that high a proportion is really creating some problems with the regard to financing and the establishment of an effective experience rating system. A lower proportion of the experience rating system can live with, but when you get too high a percentage, it makes it pretty rough to establish an equitable system. Further, we've been advised by the Manpower Administration of the U.S. Department of Labor that the provisions of 2247 might pose some question as to whether it meets the requirements of federal law. The Section 303A5 of the Social Security Act and 3304A4 of the Federal Unemployment Tax Act require that the state's law restrict the use of money in the state's unemployment fund, with just a few certain exceptions, in the payment of unemployment compensation. And compensation generally has been construed to mean cash benefits available to individuals with respect to their unemployment, and furthermore, that it be based on the loss of prior earnings to individuals who are unemployed because of lack of work. And of course, this provision would not be in this bill because an individual would not have to have any prior earnings to qualify. So they comment that since the benefits would be wholly unrelated to prior wages, that in their opinion would not be consistent with compensation, meaning the federal law. Now, this is a preliminary indication that we have. And I have attached the language of Section 303A5 and 3304A4 of the Federal Unemployment Tax. It's kind of hard to assess the impact of House Bill 2247, but as we understand the program, which the requesters of the bill, Associated General Contractors, would include the short-term training that's part of the required continued employment for certain types of individuals employed by Associated General Contractors, such as carpenters, millwrights, and so forth. But there are an addition, at least about 4,700 individuals currently in apprenticeship training in the state. And we understand the limited program and the structure, most of these individuals could possibly qualify to draw benefits under the unemployment program during the short periods of education and training as part of the apprenticeship work. Now, most of these apprenticeship people now receive training allowances and cut funds that have been established by the employer. But we presume that with the availability of the unemployment insurance program, that these private other trust funds would not be used, and use the unemployment insurance trust fund to pay the benefit. In addition, if the provisions of 2247 were liberally interpreted, there could be several thousand more individuals possibly qualify for up to 4 weeks of maximum benefits each year. And the impact if 750 individuals qualified and do 4 weeks of benefits at $95 a week, it would be an impact of $285,000 additional benefits paid in fiscal 75. If as many as 5,000 individuals, which would be about the number of people in apprenticeship training, do the 4 weeks at $95, it would add about a close to $1,900,000 in unemployment insurance payments. Just for information purposes, during fiscal 74, the amount of benefits paid under the present vocational training provisions of the law was $125,000.
How are you going to pair amendments to get around this?
As far as the certain portions of it, the objections that the Manpower Administration has raised as far as allowing benefits to individuals who have had no prior earnings, there could not be any amendment drafted that would
Mr. Jay, I can't hear you.
You could not draft an amendment.
Bill, will you close that door?
Which would overcome the objection that the individual who qualifies for benefits could qualify with no prior work experience.
We can't circumvent.
We could not, under the unemployment program, draft an amendment which would overcome that. There's other features of the bill that some amendment could be drafted which would permit payment to some of these individuals if they were unemployed and so forth.
If they've actually dealt with it.
If they
scope of the unemployment law as it is.
Scope of the unemployment law as it is, but they would not be eligible for the maximum. They'd be eligible for whatever benefits they might be able to qualify on with the wages that they have been paid.
Well, if they actually fell within the scope of the law right now, they could be going to school as long as they're old for work, they wouldn't need it.
If it's an approved program of instruction. Now, there's certain requirements that Section 657.345 lays out some criteria for the administrator to base his approval of continued drawing of unemployment benefits while the individual is in vocational training. In many cases, possibly some of these individuals would qualify for this short period. As I understand it, most of it is 4 to 6 weeks period that the individuals that are employed by Associated General Contractor employers are sent to a specific training facility for 4 to 6 weeks, and this is generally during the period of time while the individual is unemployed with no work available, generally during the winter months. Some of the individuals that we speak to are probably eligible under the current law if they have very little skills and so forth, and they're in an occupation that's very little likelihood for them to have continued employment.
Another question. Some along the lines, Representative Wolfer asked you about the packing. I realize the contractors right at the top. Percentage. What percentage do they pay what they employees take out?
Again, this is calendar 1973 information. The total contract construction industry taxes were about $5.4 million, benefits $7.8. The heavy construction type of employer taxes of $1.3 million, benefits of $3.3 million.
1.3? 1.3. 3.3. 3.3. That's
what?
That's running about
2.5 to 1. The special trades are a little bit more. I mean, that's plumbing, heating, that type. The tax collections in 73 slightly exceeded the amount of benefits paid. Building contractors themselves was about $1.5 in benefits to each dollar.
You mentioned that there were 45,000 people involved in the apprenticeship of children.
This is the information that we got.
And so you drew on 5,000 and you drew upon 4 weeks unemployed. That, I assume, is pretty average.
Well, the bill itself speaks to availability of benefits during a limited program of instruction not to exceed 30 weeks,
what's
or 30
been,
days.
What's been the work experience for these types of people in an apprenticeship program? Are they indeed unemployed on an average of 4 weeks a year?
We do. I don't have any information. I don't believe the employment division has any information on those individuals involved in apprenticeship programs. The information that associated with the contractors had, I can just kind of speak roughly, indicated that during the months of November, December, January, February, that most of the individuals that they were speaking to are unemployed. There's very little weeks of employment.
Is this also true that for the apprenticeship
period?
I'm trying to get some basis of irrespective of the federal problem, what this would cost us. Now, we're running about $2.5 million deficit now, and if we involve an exposure of 5,000 additional individuals, would they indeed be unemployed for a period of 4 weeks?
If they were separated from their job and were sent to a limited program to take their educational training separately. Now many of them do this while they're on the job, I believe. This is the way I understand
it. Well, I'm trying to get a social,
if there were 5,000 of them, it could add another $2 million approximately.
Exposure being four. Thank you.
Now I'll ask you another. Jack said here, and I knew you were working on a possible amendment to make work. The employment division is working on that type of amendment with Jack. How long is that going to take? We have been looking at the situation that they're speaking to, and we have possibly an alternative. We haven't discussed this with Jack Kalinowski yet to see whether it would, unless Ed Northcutt has been doing it behind me.
I'm getting concerned because practically everything we try to work on, somebody said, well, we have some amendments, and quite frankly, Chair's going to put a stop to this in short order. He's going to have amendments in for a work session, and we're not even going to look at them. We're just going to go ahead and do what we're going to do with the bill. But if there is some amendment you're working on, I'm willing to set this over to next week, to the next week's work session, if there will be something in on it. And that will be it.
Mr. Chairman, we tried to work out something here a couple of weeks ago, and we still haven't got any agreement on what we can do that will still accomplish the purpose of the bill and yet still be acceptable to the federal court.
Well, we're going to set up a work session a week from Thursday again, at least half a day of it. And if there isn't something in by then, bye, baby.
Very good.
Let's see. Drew, you have something you wanted to discuss?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On House Bill 2086, have some newly drafted proposed amendments.
Which bill?
2086. Unit pricing bill.
I'll just put over to the next first order of business at our next work session.
No, it was just put off. It wasn't put over.
It wasn't put over, but he has something he wants to discuss.
That's my time.
If you want to have somebody come in and talk on it, we will do it. Like I told you before. But he has some amendments he wants to discuss.
I also have some amendments that Derek wrote.
I also have
some. Oh, boy.
Well, I'll tell you what let's do. Let's set it over to the first order of business our next work day and get it. That would be the simplest way to go about it, otherwise we're going to be... How's that?
Okay, fine. Thank you.
All right. Chat when I was here for now. Let's get back to... Twenty-one fifty-seven. which we were waiting.
Yeah.
Supposed to be some amendments in on it. Pardon? I told him he was going to hear it as soon as we got square around.
Oh, you did. I thought it
was three. Well, like I said, we did set a time certain for three. I thought so. Well, that's right. That's right. We did. So now I'll take care of that. But keep it handy. Negotiation and executive session.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I would move to table 2073.
Are there any more of these tables? House Bill 2073, the clerk, call the roll.
Pardon?
No.
Yes.
No.
No.
Aye.
No. Anybody have anything to say about 2073?
Mr. Chairman, just to kind of refresh my memory on this, we worked on it. Right now, the station, the whole executive station is now, I believe, under.
All right, right now, if they want to have executive station, one side or the other, if we're talking about labor negotiations, public sector. One side or the other has to request it. And if one side or the other requests it, then the employer will set the rules by which they will have it, or if they admit somebody, the employer will set the rules. But they have to request an executive session. And in an executive session, they can request and be there under certain rules that will be set by the employer. And this would make it so that they wouldn't have to request it. It's always automatically an executive session. Labor negotiation. Basically, what it does.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Let me get an opinion there from.
From who?
From labor.
From labor?
Yes.
There isn't any public employee labor people out there. This is strictly for public employees. Liberty bill.
Who was that? Who was that moved the table?
Representative Morris.
I'd like to make a motion again.
Would you like to make a motion?
Representative Morris moves to table 2073.
Okay.
Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
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 Table. We'll have a 10-minute recess at 3 o'clock.
This is fair. We're saying to the labor organization, you can't go outside at all, period. But the employer can, at least twice.
Well, the intent behind the law is, say, for example, you have someone who works at the plant, let's say they have an annual, or say biannual, or strike, or not strike, but labor contract, what's up every 2 years. And this guy just doesn't go along with, you know, the union. So he crosses the picket line and goes to work anyway. In other words, the intent, I'm not set on the word, I mean, you know, whatever's fair. But then that guy goes across the picket line as an employee of that plant. And true, in a sense, he's sort of a strike breaker, but not a professional strike breaker, because he's only worked for that, you know, that particular company. And that's why that's in there now, is
and I'm, you know, I don't care about the wreath so much, as long as it's just that kind of situation, that the guy who, say, doesn't want to go along with the union or something, is an employee there, and he goes across the picket line, and just for the fact that there have been two strikes in the last two negotiations, he's classified the third time around as a professional, for say an annual contract. He's as a professional strike breaker, even though he's never worked anywhere else. See?
That bill wouldn't say it. It doesn't mean that.
Well, I know.
Here's an amendment.
Okay, cool.
Mr. Chairman, I handed out the amendments, the last amendment.
That's what I just pointed out.
Yeah, and that's what
you guys would speak to.
Spell it out. There's no question about it.
Representative Wolfer's comment,
yeah,
right.
But we're.
And I still.
Oh, no, we're on this other amendment.
Right, we're on another amendment. I realize that. So.
Anything further on Representative Wilhelm's amendment?
No.
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 Aye.
No.
I just picked it up. Can I take a walk? Not really. It's not going to make much difference. Before we start in, on another one, Representative Wilhelm.
Pardon me?
Before we start in on another, we would be happy to have that drafted in the bill and put it into the committee.
Well, it seems to me like that would be an exercise of futility.
Not necessary.
Not necessary?
Not necessary.
Well, I happen to have some copies there in my office, Mr. Chairman.
All righty, now, Representative.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this time I would like to amend the bill. I move to amend 2157 with proposed amendments before you on page 2, line 25, strike the word personnel and insert there, or an employee employed by the employer at the beginning of the duration of a strike or lockout. This, I move that, and I'm going to make a comment.
You didn't mean to strike the word personnel. Your written amendment says after the word personnel.
Yeah.
You want to leave personnel in.
Yeah.
After you do.
Yeah.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, you want to leave personnel in, right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Right. You're correct. Okay. Want to leave personnel in, strike the period. So moved.
You all have a copy of this amendment? Any discussion? The phone company, and what it does is makes them feel a little bit, I don't think it means anything, but it makes them feel happy. You want to know where it came from.
Is it important to make them happy, Mr. Chairman?
He'll turn off the phone.
We want to get along with Gary, I guess it is.
He's bigger than
not me.
Discussion on the amendment?
Could require a $500 deposit.
Really, if you read it, it doesn't change the bill at all. It just makes them happy. They're already covered in that respect.
We can make a small bill. Yeah.
Why do you look at me when you say that? Let me see the president down.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Amendment.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I have another amendment proposed.
All righty.
And
This would read on page 3 of the printed bill after line 8.
After line 8.
You would insert a new section 4 and then renumber 4 to 5 and 5 to 6. And the new section 4 would read, if a labor organization pays individuals for their services as pickets during a labor dispute, lockout, or strike, and the monies used for that purpose do not come from a strike fund of the labor organization, the individual serving as pickets must be paid the minimum wage rate established under ORS 653.025. Oh, you don't need copies of the amendment?
Yeah. Matter of fact, yes.
Well, yeah.
What do you expect me to do? Hold on.
Basically, what the amendment does, Mr. Chairman, is just require that if there are going to be any pickets hired to be pickets in the state of Oregon.
Yeah.
Now, that's not paid with strike fund money, but if they're actually hired to be pickets, then the labor organization's got to pay them the minimum wage. Or more.
They may be more than that.
It could be more than that if they'd like to pay them more.
Wouldn't they be required to now?
I don't think that that's included under the minimum wage.
I certainly would like to see the labor organization that would not pay minimum wage.
That's right.
Allie, do you know whether you do or not?
Pardon?
You know whether you do or not? Here's one of the organizations that hires pickets.
How about the
only other one I know that does it is the Culinary Alliance.
Could I ask a question?
There's no objection. I'm getting at it. They already do it. There's no objection having it in there.
Well, we must do that contribution.
No, well, I'm kind of curious who gets hired as pickets. Well, it might be after all this gold.
Employer needs a little extra money.
No, but I'm curious. A minute ago, we tabled a bill which would have controlled professional pickets. Now, there was said in testimony here at this committee that we don't have a problem with professional pickets, but now we've got the AFL-CIO in the back of the room saying that they do, in fact, hire pickets. Now, if they hire pickets, they must be professional pickets.
Can I maybe answer that to some degree anyway?
You certainly may.
I think in the cases wherein I made to realize that there was one of my own jurisdictions that occurred, where an individual and a union struck a business, doesn't mean different why, but the picket was on to the employee who worked there, picketed that establishment for approximately 18 months, 5 days, 6 days, a week. From time to time, that lady had to take some time off and needed some support. Somebody was indeed then to take her place on the picket line and was paid, and I'm not sure how much, to do this. In this particular case, now this person, to the best of my knowledge, took the employee's place on the picket line, was indeed from that industry and a member of the union. And to my knowledge, I don't know of any others, but you could hardly call that person professional pickets, because they probably most likely would be working and doing this in lieu of maybe possible work that they were laid off, or they might have been on their day off or something like this. Now, I can't substantiate that fact, but I'm sure that this, in my own mind, is the case, and at least that.
But this. They would pay them the minimum wage, would they not?
Oh, certainly. More.
Well, there's good people out there walking the picket line, have it guaranteed.
But
other employees have a guarantee under the minimum wage law to the picket.
They would, otherwise they wouldn't be picketing, I think.
I don't know. The pickets themselves, who are a member of the labor organization, or work for the particular company or organization, business firm, whatever, that's being struck, are not receiving pay at all.
Well, I understand that. And we're not talking about people that are in members of the organization. We're not talking about people who are receiving compensation from the strike fund. Talking about people who have been hired by the labor organization to walk the line.
Outside of the organization.
Outside of the
organization.
Any further discussion?
I can't imagine labor organization having a problem paying these people.
Well, I can't imagine the president of the FL-CIO building a non-union house, too, but, you know, a non-union house, you have labor.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, call for the question on the amendment.
Question's been called for. Your amendment, do you have anything final to say, folks?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Segment?
No.
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 Aye.
No.
Aye.
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 Quite frankly, I'm going to vote aye, because if they already do it, I can't see where they have any objection to it.
Way of a bold explanation, Mr. Chairman, maybe because they already do it, and much more so, I felt it unnecessary and waste of time.
Mr. Chairman, boy,
pass
it also.
It passes.
It passes and adopted.
We had one amendment that we passed earlier.
Yes.
Is this in order to reconsider?
Sure.
I
just so you get it done, the next 35 minutes we have a talk.
Okay, I hope so. After I started looking at this, I really had seen some problems in this amendment that we passed earlier. Or an employee employed by the employer at the beginning of the duration of a strike or lockout. Now, I see here a chance for an employer to run out and hire somebody at the beginning of the duration of a strike or lockout and put several people on the payroll and use them in place of those that aren't on strike. And if this builds it in, right into the law.
Did I hear you move before you started? Will you reconsider our vote on that?
Yes. And I think what we're saying is that the employer can go ahead, put somebody on the payroll the day of the beginning of the duration of the strike. And for all intents and purposes, it does just the thing we're talking about here. It accomplishes putting strike breakers on a payroll. Now, I don't know if I'm correct in reading it that way, and I sure would like to hear some testimony from some individuals on this and their feelings on it. I may be wrong.
Mr. Chairman.
That's Andy Willis.
Well, I can understand Mr. Kreft's concern because it would appear there are two contexts here. What if we were to say were any employee currently employed by the employer at the beginning of the duration of the or some other wording that would indicate that they were on the payroll at the time of lockout or this workplace just began.
Currently wouldn't change it.
You can run somebody in the day that the strike starts and put them on the payroll, and all of a sudden they're there, and therefore they're going to come under the same exemption as supervisory personnel. Now, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I sure would like to hear
Mr. Chairman.
Mr.
try to alleviate your concern, why don't you put in the change that the employee has to be employed for 30-day period of time, something like that. I think that's going to limit your problem.
An employee for an organizational strikeout for the previous 30 days or something?
Yeah, yeah, he's been there for 30 days. It's safe assumption. He wasn't hired for it.
And in regard to that, in these cases, an employee who goes to work for an employer has 30 days, 45 days to join a union. And they join or whatever, and I'm worried about 30 days, 45 days, any of these days. I really feel that we should repeal this amendment, do away with it. I think it has built in lots of tricks in it that I'm very leery of it.
Any further discussion? Let's end the day.
Mr. Chairman, I think the intent of the bill is to get away from the professional strike breaker. This is a person that they fly in and whatnot, and can decide people to beat people up in a picket line or whatnot, and such type.
I don't believe they're limited to flying.
Well, walking or whatever. my own personal looking at this bill is, I'm looking for the professional strike breaker. I'm not looking for someone that that might be working for the facility at that time or hired one day prior to that time. I don't think that would constitute him as a professional strike breaker if you hired him the day before or something.
Which it could possibly, if you go back way back, they could do this for one industry and then go to work the day before the strike begins when they know it, everybody knows when it's going to begin. And then they go, then they, as soon as it's settled, they quit there and they go to another industry and go to work a day earlier. And it could be very well be professional strike breaker.
Okay.
And then this, very easily.
Well, Mr. Chairman, though, that particular problem you're alluding to address under the prior wording in that section.
No, because this would excuse that prior wording.
Anybody hired at the beginning of the duration of the strike or lockout would be exempted the same as supervisory personnel, and that doubles it. The whole person. So,
could very well.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, can that 30-day period of time overcome that problem?
I feel not. I
mean, if I'm going to hire a professional strike breaker, I'm sure not going to put him on the payroll for 30 days to circumvent your concern.
Question? I guess everybody's had their say. Agnes? This is a motion to reconsider the bill.
No, reconsider an amendment.
Okay. All right.
It's not a vote on
whether we should reconsider.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
No.
No. Aye.
Aye. Now we're in a position of doing what we started out, what we've already been discussing. Do you care? Do you move to reconsider? Now, do you want to move? Do we delete that?
Move to delete the amendment as adopted.
All right. Now, does anybody have a quickie to say on that? I think we just about said it.
Question.
Agnes?
Aye.
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 No.
Right.
No.
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 Aye. 5-4. And remove. Now, did I hear somebody move? Send bill before the two pass as amended? Did I hear you say that, bud?
No.
Okay, no. Bill before the due pass as amended. Any discussion on that? We got it all talked out. Question. Question's been called for. Agnes?
Aye.
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 Rechner?
Aye.
Rogers?
No.
Rohm?
No.
Rocker?
No, for the purposes of a possible minority report.
Aye. For the two pass as amended.
Mr. Chairman,
I believe recommended. Wait just a minute. I think Representative Crest should carry the bill. Now,
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to put notice of a possible minority report.
So noted. Nothing else to come forth with.